Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. As Election Day draws near, we're continuing our discussions with some of the candidates vying for national, state, and local office. Today, a conversation with two new political contenders campaigning under the Maryland Green Party's progressive banner. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a licensed pediatrician and healthcare reform activist. She's running for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski. And Ninabu Eze, an IT consultant from Pikesville, is facing off against incumbent Democrat John Sarbanes in Maryland's 3rd congressional district. We'll spend the next hour exploring their stands on a range of local and national issues, and we'll take your calls. It's Midday, midweek. We'll get going right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. The November 8th elections are less than 6 weeks away, and the campaigns for the White House, the U.S. Congress, and a long list of state and local elective offices are in high gear. Today, we're going to spend some time with two Green Party candidates. Dr. Margaret Flowers is running against Congressman Chris Van Hollen and Delegate Kathy Shalega for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski. Ninabu Eze is running against incumbent Democratic Congressman John Sarbanes and Dr. Mark Plaster, the Republican running to represent Maryland's 3rd congressional district. As of this summer, there were over 100 Green Party office holders in 23 states across the United States, from mayors to city councils to members of school boards. At the national level, Dr. Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka are the Green nominees for president and vice president, a ticket that's polling at about 2%. Gary Johnson and William Weld are running on the Libertarian ticket. They are polling at somewhere between 5 and 9% in national polls these days. The Maryland Green Party has put forward several candidates for seats on the Baltimore City Council, and a mayoral candidate, Joshua Harris, was my guest recently here on WYPR. So a little bit about my guest this afternoon. Margaret Flowers is 53 years old. She's a mother of three and a licensed pediatrician. She spent almost 20 years working in Carroll County hospitals and in private practice before devoting herself in 2007 to full-time advocacy for state and national health insurance reform and other progressive causes. She is co-director of PopularResistance.org, an online information hub for social activism, and she co-hosts a radio show, Clearing the Fog. She lives in Baltimore's Lake Evesham neighborhood. She has never held elective office, and Dr. Flowers, welcome to Midday. It's nice to meet you.
It's great to meet you. My kids always came to your Christmas shows.
So, oh, terrific. Yeah. Great. Well, I appreciate that. Ninabu Eze joins us as well. Mr. Eze is 47 years old. He was born in Nigeria and came to the United States when he was 7. He grew up in Glassboro, New Jersey. He graduated from Rutgers University in 1995 and moved to Maryland the following year. He lives in Pikesville with his wife, Kioma, and their two children, and he works as an information technology consultant. He, too, has never held elective office. Mr. Eze, it's nice to meet you as well.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, Dr. Flowers, let's start with you. Tell us about your background. Tell us
You hit on some of it. You know, I practiced pediatrics. I did my medical school here at University of Maryland and my residency at Hopkins. And what I found when I was out in practice, as many doctors find, is that our health system is not actually designed to support the health of our population. It's really a system that's designed to make profit for the medical industry. And over time, you know, like other primary care physicians, I grew frustrated with the fact that there are so many obstacles in the way to providing good quality care. So I decided to leave practice and fight that good fight. And that really led me down the road to see so many other issues that are connected to health and to see that our political system is not designed to represent the interest of the public. They're not interested in, you know, real evidence of what would work. Our legislation is by and large written by the corporations, and the Democrats and Republicans are not willing to really challenge them. So after fighting so long on the outside, and I've spent a lot of time in Congress trying to change things there, it, you know, became pretty clear that we need to build an alternative and a party that actually represents the interests of the people. So that's why I'm running.
So tell me about the organizations with whom you were working, the activism that you were doing. What were they called? Where were they based?
Sure,
what kind of work did you
actually do? So I was co-chair of the Maryland chapter of Physicians for National Health Program, and I serve as an advisor to the board of the national organization. This is 20,000 physicians around the country that support an improved Medicare for All health system. And during 2000, well, we, for previous 2 years before 2008, we had been meeting as a large large coalition of organizations of labor, other health organizations, community faith-based groups, and knowing that health reform would come around at some point. And so that was called the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare. And then during the health reform process, we actually started meeting with members of Congress in December of 2008, saying, when you move forward with your legislation, we want you to consider our proposal on the basis of how many people are covered, how much it would cost, because we knew that an improved Medicare for All system would win on both of those counts. And we were told by even leadership, sure, of course we'll do that. But then as soon as the first hearing started in the Senate Finance Committee, it was pretty clear that they were shutting us out. And when we tried to push to have a nationally recognized health finance expert testify in the Senate Finance Committee. She was also a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. They refused to allow her. So a number of us stood up in that committee hearing and said, you know, you're shutting these voices out. And this is what 80% of Democrats, the majority of the public, want: a healthcare system that's about health, a national improved Medicare for All system.
So you were involved in this way before Obamacare even
right.
was a thing that people were actually, you know, actively talking about.
Right. And yeah. I had been fighting for it for years, even, you know, prior to that. And that whole experience was really clear. I mean, I met a lot of health staffers that didn't even have a background in health policy. So we spent a lot of time that summer just educating them about health policy, holding congressional briefings and bringing people in. And it was pretty clear that the whole system was rigged and designed to have the outcome that it had. And we didn't see that as a solution. We see it as taking us in the wrong direction, and that we need to be creating a real health system that's about health. So that really opened my eyes, but also broadened my perspective on how do we actually shift political power to get the changes that we need. And that means that we have to see healthcare. The healthcare fight is part of the broader struggle for social and economic and racial justice.
So. All right, we'll talk a good bit about that as our conversation continues. And Mr. Eze, how about you, your background and how you got involved in politics?
Well, I've been in IT for over 15 years. Started with financial services, then moved on. Now I'm currently a federal government contractor. I'm an independent contractor, and got into politics because as a business analyst, you analyze issues with systems. Then you make recommendations, and then based on approval of those recommendations, you find solutions. I found out that our politicians are not analyzing our issues, but they're kicking the problems down the road. In Maryland, I found out that, like Bernie Sanders said, you have people working 40 hours a week, but living in abject poverty. And the basis for my campaign, for my platform, is the universal guaranteed income. As a guaranteed income for everybody. Right now, I would like to start with people 18 years old and over. That's about 242 million Americans. The time to do it is now, because a lot of the jobs are being eliminated by technology. Technologies, like last week, I went to a gas station that I normally go to, and I could pay for my gas in cash at the pump, not having to go inside. And usually they have three cashiers inside the store. Now they only have one. And as you know, Uber is now testing driverless cars. What's going to happen to the taxi drivers, the Uber drivers, the ambulance drivers? There's about 3.5 million Americans that's going to lose their job because of technology. How are we going to, even manufacturers also going automated.
Mm-hmm. And as a member of Congress, were you to be elected, what would you be able to do to move the country towards universal guaranteed income? I mean, do you find that there's a groundswell? Do you find that there's a lot of support for that?
Yes.
Because there's no data that indicates that that's something that's on most people's radars.
This is not a new concept. Milton Friedman had a similar concept in 1962, the negative income tax. Even Nixon even brought it up, a form of guaranteed income. So it's not a new concept. In Alaska now, they pay their residents the oil revenues and dividend. So it's not a new concept, but I believe I can get bipartisan support, because very soon, there's 40 million Americans between the ages of 25 and 65 that are unemployed. 7 million have stopped looking for work. That number is going to grow, because people are going to start losing their jobs, and we're going to start manufacturing goods with nobody to buy them. So that's why we need, now is the time for a basic income guarantee.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Flowers, what do you think about that idea?
Well, I support it as well. And I think that this is a role that the alternative parties play and have always played throughout history, is that right now we have two political parties that are dominated by wealth, and their whole conversation is within a very narrow spectrum. And so you need political parties that are able to talk outside of that spectrum and broaden the public debate about the issues that we're facing and the solutions that are not being talked about. Historically, when we need political transformation, it requires an activated social movement and then a political party that represents the values of that social movement. And that's really where we are right now.
And about what are your estimates of the cost of providing a basic guaranteed income to more than 240 million
people? It's interesting how we always bring up, whenever we have a policy that benefits the people, the question is, well, how are we going to pay for it?
Is that an invalid question?
Well,
you're right.
We don't have any, how did we come up with the $16 trillion that we used to bail out the Wall Street banks? How do we come up with the trillions of dollars that we've spent on war? What about the billions, hundreds of billions that we're spending on corporate subsidies and tax breaks for the wealthy and, all of the billions, hundreds of billions of dollars that are offshored? There's a lot of money that, is being given to those at the top, and we're seeing a clear trend of consolidation of wealth at the top while poverty is growing. And now the bottom 50% of our population are sharing 1% of the country's wealth. That's not a sustainable situation. We need to start investing in people at the bottom so that we can stimulate the economy from the bottom up. And that's one thing that the guaranteed income does. And it will actually stimulate our economy and have a positive effect of people spending into it, creating more jobs, raising people up. And so if we start just looking at, like Alaska did, we're getting ready to move into, if we use common sense and realize that the climate crisis needs to be addressed quickly and in a full-scale manner, we could move quickly into scaling up to a new green economy. Instead of taking public money and investing that into private corporations, the technology, the research that we do, handing that over to private interest to profit from, if we see that as a public investment with a return to the public, we can grow that into a guaranteed basic income pretty quickly over time.
So in Alaska, it's the oil revenue
right.
that does it. And you're
right.
saying that in the mainland, as they call it up there, it could be done by having public ownership of green energy companies or green energy services?
Public partnerships, or if we do have public investment in technology that a private entity is taking over, then there needs to be a return on that investment to the public.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Eze, why the Green Party for you? I mean, why not run in one of the two major parties? What can you do as a Green Party candidate that you can't do as a Democrat?
Well, because Green Party, there's two issues that are at my, that I have a passion for. That's social justice and
grassroots democracy or peace?
And grassroots democracy.
Social justice and grassroots democracy. And,
exactly.
And you find that those are absent from the mainstream parties, Democrats or Republicans?
Yes, because this is 25 years after Rodney. I didn't want to run as a Democrat because 25 years after Rodney King beating, we're still talking about police reform. Now, after these riots happen, the politicians will come out and say the key words. We need to have more investment. We need empowerment. We need social justice, but nothing gets done. I just kicked the issue down the road. Just like my opponent, John Sarbanes, he's talking about campaign reform, and he has a Governing Body People Act. He's talking about the government campaign reform and passed a co-sponsored a Governing Body People's Act. But he did not. He's not leading by example. He's still taking campaign contributions from over 40 corporations.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about that after we take a break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guests today are two Green Party candidates running to represent Maryland in the U.S. Congress. Dr. Margaret Flowers is vying for the Senate seat being vacated by Barbara Mikulski, and Abu Eze is the Green Party candidate for Maryland's 3rd Congressional District. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll take your calls and comments. But first, it's our fall membership campaign. Speaking of money, thanks to everybody who's pledged so far to help sustain all of the programs that you hear on your public radio. We're going to send it back to Andy Bienstock and Sheila Cast, who can tell you how you can become a member of WIPR. And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR. Looking ahead here on Midday, coming up tomorrow, our monthly Health Watch show with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. She'll be talking about the city's new blueprint for delivering more equitable health and wellness services to Baltimore residents. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have a review of Wait Until Dark, the show that is opening the Everyman Theater's new season. That's all coming up on Midday Thursday. My guests this afternoon are two Maryland Green Party candidates vying for seats in the U.S. Congress. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a Baltimore resident and licensed pediatrician who's running for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated next January by Senator Barbara Mikulski. That seat is also being sought by Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen and Republican delegate Kathy Shalega. Inabu Eze is also here with us in Studio A. He's the Green Party candidate for Maryland's 3rd Congressional District, a seat held since 2007 by the incumbent Democrat Representative John Sarbanes, who's also facing a challenge from Republican Mark Plaster. Mark Plaster. We'd love to have you join the conversation. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can send me a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So, Dr. Flowers, how about you? Why the Green Party as opposed to either of the mainstream parties?
So what's become pretty clear to me is that if someone runs within the Democratic or Republican Party, they're pretty much controlled in terms of what policies they can support and promote. And this was very clear to me when Donna Edwards ran in 2008. I supported her run. I was a Democrat then. She ran on a single-payer platform. As soon as she was in Congress, the party was able to control her, and she was no longer talking about single payer. Even when we tried to push her at town forums and events, she stayed to her talking points. We see very clearly on a broad range of issues. Right now, I've been fighting the Trans-Pacific Partnership for the last 5 years, and the Democrats have their lockstep in their talking point on this. And so if we're actually going to address the issues, we need to have the freedom to be able to speak to solutions that aren't being talked about, that majorities of people support. When you're in that party structure, there's just way too much control. And I know for a fact that if I ran in the Democratic Party, I would not advance very far. You know, if you look at the health reform process and what happened to Dennis Kucinich, he was the final Democrat to hold out fighting for a single-payer system, and they quickly redistricted his district and worked to get him unelected.
Are there issues in which there is a good divergence between you and Dr. Stein or Mr. Baraka in terms of the head of the Green Party ticket in this election?
Divergence? No, I would say that I've worked with Dr. Stein and John Mabraka for a long time. I fully support using a human rights framework to public policy, as John Mabraka is recognized as an international human rights defender. No, I would say that we're pretty similar in our platforms.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Eze, one of the things that concerns me, and I'll use the word concern, is that there's one issue of the viability of any third party candidate, you know, Green Party candidates. Obviously, you start with, less name recognition, less financial support. I mean, according to the latest financial reports with the folks who track this sort of thing, you haven't raised any money at all for your campaign. You have a Facebook page. The last post on the Facebook page was in July. You know, it's very difficult to find any information about you. Our producer was looking for information about you. There is a question as to whether or not this run is anything more than sort of a vanity affair for you. Is this a serious candidacy, and why is it that do you think people should take your candidacy seriously and actually consider you as an alternative to a person with the kind of experience of John Sarbanes, for example, who has been in Congress for a long time, has an excellent record in constituent service, or even, you know, Dr. Plaster, who's also been involved in community as a community activist for a long time?
Well, this is the year of the outsider, and this had been an unusual election year. And we've learned from the primaries that money is no longer an issue to win a candidacy. Donald Trump, Jeb Bush was one of the, he spent about $130 million, but he's one of the first few Republicans to exit the race. And Donald Trump spent the least, and he's now the candidate for the Republicans. So I don't think...
But what is it about you, sir, that qualifies you to consider and represent a congressional district in a variety, a wide swath of issues that affect our country?
Well, I have, I believe my experience, I can bring my experience as a IT consultant. I dissect issues. I look where the problems are. I make recommendations, and I resolve them. Mr. Sarbanes, he has been kicking issues down the road for a while. He has, there has been, actually, the politicians in general, there's been a gridlock in Washington. They cannot get anything done, so why should we continue to vote for the same people? They have about a 7% approval rate, I believe, Congress does. So they're not really doing anything, but because they're being controlled by the corporation, the corporations, the billionaires and millionaires. I have not taken a dime from any corporation, so I'm going to go to Washington and represent the people. I'm not going to, because what's happening is John Sarbanes is not representing the corporations that's giving him money.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't dispute that you haven't taken money from corporations, but on the other hand, you've got no resources, it seems to me, to get even, you know, a basic message out to folks. And I think that's, you know, obviously got to be of a concern. We're going to go to the phones now. Carlos in Baltimore is joining Midday with our two Green Party candidates, Dr. Margaret Flowers and Inabu Eze. Carlos, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much for having me. I wanted to ask, I've noticed that the Baltimore Sun very rarely talks about Dr. Margaret Flowers. And was she going to be included in the televised debate so that the public could get a feel of some of the ideas that she's presenting so that we can hear those compared to the other candidates in an open forum?
Thank you, Carlos. The last information I have about that is that you have not been invited to be in the in those debates with Congressman Van Hollen and Delegate Shalhoub. Any news on that?
I was able to get into two forums that have already passed that I was in. There's going to be a radio debate on the Kojo Namdi show on October 7th. I've contacted WAMU multiple times, emailed the Kojo Namdi show, and they won't even return my calls or my emails, which is very disappointing. I did reach out to all of the sponsors of the debate for October 26th at the University of Baltimore Center for Public Policy. In fact, when the head of the Center for Public Policy refused to meet with me, I went down to her office early one morning and insisted that we'd speak anyway.
Because, so is this a sort of a chicken and the egg thing? I mean,
yeah.
And obviously they're making their determination based on a 15% recognition in the polls, and you're polling it considerably less than that.
So we have a pay-to-play system. The Baltimore Sun has rarely covered my campaign. They've definitely, you know, Kathy Shalhoub thinks about running, she gets a full article. I announce that I'm running, and after, you know, pushing, they put an article, and it was a very poorly, from my perspective, did not portray the differences between me and the Democratic candidate. Started out right off the bat saying she has no chance of winning. So there's been very unfair coverage. The Washington Post, I did a Senate forum. All three of us were there. Kathy Shalhoub and Chris Van Hollen get mentioned in the headline. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of information about their policies. I get the very last line. So
Let's talk a little bit about this notion of unfairness, because I understand where you're coming from.
Right.
Is it, in fact, unfair? Is it untrue that you don't have a chance of winning? What is your path to winning a Senate election here in Maryland, which is in which Democrats outnumber Green Party candidates something 200-something to 1.
And in Baltimore,
87%
of registered Democrats don't even vote. They are not inspired to vote. So it's a system that is run by the Democratic and Republican parties. They make the rules. They design the rules to exclude, you know, alternative party candidates. The media should have a role to actually educate voters about who their choices are, but instead of giving a chance for my ideas to be aired in the public, you know, in the public air, where I've been excluded from that. I'm being excluded from the debates. Of course I'm being, you know, polling at 2%. The majority of people don't know that I'm running, although I've been making a lot of effort to get out there one-on-one. I'm not taking the millions of dollars that allow me to buy airtime, et cetera. So I think that it's very disappointing for me that the University of Baltimore Center for Public Policy would exclude a voice that actually I'm very informed about public policy and would expand the debate, but instead they're shutting it down and restricting it. So we don't know. The ideas that I'm talking about are things that are supported by majorities of the public.
All right, let's go to the phones again. And, of course, this is one of the reasons that you're here.
And I appreciate that, yeah.
Hart is calling from Baltimore, has a comment about the guaranteed income. Hart, welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you. My question is, doesn't the earned income tax credit take care of a lot of the minimum income requirements that they're talking about?
All right, Mr. Eze, instead of a guaranteed income, how about the earned income tax credit?
No, that's actually another welfare program the government give. We're trying to consolidate that into one. All the welfare programs the government currently have, basic guaranteed income, are consolidated that into one check to make it more.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that tax credits don't work for those who are at the bottom, because what a guaranteed income would do is give people a check every month so they can pay for their basic needs. Waiting once a year to get a tax refund doesn't help people and isn't sufficient.
Before we take a little break here, let me ask again, generally speaking, what's the estimate of the cost of this? I mean, when I asked you this before, you talked about the priorities, and we found the money for these other programs, but what is the actual number? Is there a number that you've
I would have to get that number to you, but we need to determine and determine what that would be across, you know, different regions. There's a cost of living, so it needs to be tied to the cost of living in various regions.
All right. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a licensed pediatrician and health reform advocate who's running for the Maryland Senate seat, being vacated by Barbara Mikulski. And Abu Eze is the Green Party candidate for Maryland's 3rd congressional district, a seat held since 2007 by the incumbent Democrat Representative John Sarbanes, who's also facing a challenge this November from Republican Mark Plaster. By the way, Dr. Plaster will be my guest here on Midday next month. We're going to take another short break and throw it back to Andy Bienstock and Sheila Cast. It's our fall membership campaign. Thanks to everybody who's made a pledge so far. If you haven't done that yet, we'd love to hear from you. Here's how. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking to two Green Party candidates this afternoon, U.S. Senate candidate Dr. Margaret Flowers and 3rd District Congressional candidate Inabu Eze. By the way, we invited Green Party 7th District Congressional candidate Miles Honig to join us today. He was unable to do so. We'd love to hear from you. What are your impressions of the Green Party across the country and here in Maryland? In the presidential election, if you're supporting Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, what effect do you think the Green Party will have on the election? In 2000, Ralph Nader and Winona LaDuke garnered 2.7% of the national vote and were roundly criticized by Democrats and even some Green Party members as having thrown the highly contested election to George W. Bush. Do you think there's a chance of that happening in this unusual election cycle? Let us know what you think. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So, Margaret Flowers, let's talk about that notion of the possibility of a third-party candidacy, either from Dr. Stein or Mr. Johnson and Mr. Weld, affecting the outcome of the national election. There are folks who say that, you know, had Mr. Nader not been in the race, we would have had a Gore presidency instead of a Bush presidency, given the fact that, you know, as of a few days ago, the race between Clinton and Trump is very close. Do you worry that if Dr. Stein and Mr. Johnson draw well enough at the polls, that it could throw the election or could allow Donald Trump to be the president? Obviously, one would assume that the Green Party issues are more closely aligned with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. If I'm wrong about that, tell me that.
Yes.
Do you really think that there is an equivalency between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
So let's first go back to the Nader myth, because that's one that's been put out there for years and has confused a lot of people. Because actually the polls showed that if Nader had not run, Bush would have done even better than he did. So, and if you look at the data, look at a state like Florida, it was Gore who lost Florida. More Democrats went and voted for Bush by 10 times, by a factor of 10, than voted for Ralph Nader in Florida. Gore lost his home state. He lost Clinton's home state. If he had won either of those states, he would have won. So Gore lost the election of 2000 because he lost the election of 2000. And we shouldn't blame it on Ralph Nader. We have to talk about the concept of democracy, because when we talk about alternative parties as spoilers, what we're basically saying is that the Democrats and the Republicans have an inherent right to our vote, and anybody who tries to challenge them is an outsider. That's not the definition of a democracy. In a democracy, people should vote for the person who earns their vote, the person that they support. And so, but the media and, you know, the message that's
put out
there.
But even if the practical effect of that is going to be, you know, a lot of folks call a vote for your candidacy a protest vote. How do you feel about that?
Well, in some ways, it's not giving, you know, not saying that you're going to continue to be complicit with the Republican and Democratic parties, which are not solving the crises that we face. If we look at the economic crisis, which is ongoing for the most of Americans, only those at the top have really recovered. If we talk about the climate crisis, the healthcare crisis, our endless wars, on and on and on, we see that there are majorities of the public who support solutions to those crises that neither the Republican or Democratic parties are delivering on. So how do you get those solutions? It's not by continuing to vote for the ones that are doing the wrong thing. We need to start to build alternative political power. And that's, again, that's the history of this country. When we had the issue of slavery, that was a huge part of our economy. The Democrats and the Whigs refused to talk about it. Abolition parties ran for decades before they finally won, before those parties kind of fell apart and Republican won. Now we have corporate power. That's the issue. We have a government that's owned by the wealthy. We have to build alternative political power.
Let's talk about some of those issues. The Senate has just overridden by a factor of 97-1 President Obama's veto of the bill that would have allowed or that will allow 9/11 victims to sue Saudi Arabia. The House is going to vote on it later this week. Mr. Eze, what do you think about, if you were in Congress today, how would you have voted on that measure?
Well, I think I would vote against it.
You would vote with the president to sustain to sustain the veto?
I mean, yes, because right now Saudi Arabia is a major ally in the Middle East, along with Israel. So we can't afford to create another enemy in the Middle East.
So Dr. Flowers, how about you?
I disagree. I would not have supported the president's veto. I think that, you know, families do have the right to sue and have justice in that situation. I think we also have the right to know what really, you know, to know what went on with our relationship with Saudi Arabia and what happened in 9/11.
Let's talk a little bit about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Trump says he'll scrap it completely. Secretary Clinton says she'll continue to improve on it. Congressman Van Hollen, who's running against you, helped craft and pass the ACA. He calls for further improvements, including calling for a public option. How does that idea strike you?
That's a critical question because the Affordable Care Act has actually moved us farther towards privatization of our health care. Its benefit, it was written by and for the health insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the private hospital industry. And so the public option was used in 2009, 2010 to confuse the public to believe that that was actually a solution and that it would move us towards single payer. Both of those are false. Right now, I call it the profiteer's option. The private health insurance companies are screaming because they're actually having to pay for more health care, which is something that they don't like to do. And they would love to have a public insurance where they can dump all of the sick patients and they can continue to cover the healthy patients. We need to enact the solution that's supported by the majority of people in the United States, and that's a national improved Medicare for all. That's the first and smallest step that we can take to start moving our healthcare system in the direction of one that's actually about health.
So again, what's the distinction between Medicare for all and the so-called public option?
So a Medicare for all system would have a system that's paid for upfront through taxes, so nobody has to pay a premium, copay, or deductible, and every single person is in it. Every health professional is in it as well, so you don't have restricted networks that keep you from going to the place that you need to go when you get sick. It's streamlined administratively. Right now, we spend more than a third of our healthcare dollars on paperwork. And so this would we would have a very small percentage, 5 to 10% would be spent on administration. Studies show us that if we do that and have the other cost savings that are involved in a single-payer system would allow us to provide high-quality comprehensive health care to everyone. What a public option does is it throws in one more insurance in a system that's full of insurances and full of bureaucracy. It does nothing to help control health care costs. And when we've done this at the state level, the public system has always failed over time because all the sick patients end up going there. They have a higher financial burden. Over time, they start jettisoning patients. They start jettisoning benefits, and finally, they fail. So the smallest step we can take is to move to a single national improved Medicare for all, and then there's a lot to do beyond that.
This notion of incrementalism, and mm-hmm. Secretary Clinton has been called an incrementalist, and Mr. Sanders, for example, was credited with this sort of sweeping, huge, impactful reforms. Tell me what you think about that, because what you're talking about now seems to be a somewhat incremental approach to getting towards healthcare that is paid for by the government for everybody.
Moving to a national improved Medicare for all system would immediately put everybody into the same system that's financed up front publicly.
Immediately put the health insurance business out of business.
Exactly. They don't play a positive role in our health system. They actually play a negative role because they segment the risk pools, they increase the bureaucracy, and they're designed to deny paying for care. You know, we did an audit here in Maryland of Blue Cross Blue Shield in 2004 and found that they just literally were tossing out one in every five claims that was a valid claim and not paying it. We had one of our state delegates that got a mammogram and knew that it was supposed to be covered, and Blue Cross denied payment for that. Mm-hmm. And she was actually, savvy enough to know that, oh, wait, no, you are supposed to pay for this, and fought back. But most people don't have that knowledge.
All right, we have a comment from Kay in Ten Hills who says, totally agree with Dr. Flowers that the Green Party candidates should be given better media coverage and access to the debate stage. So you've got Kay in your corner. Mr. Eze, in addition to guaranteed income for everybody, what are the other big issues that you think are important in this election?
The campaign finance reform.
And Mr. Sarbanes has been a leading advocate for campaign finance reform, and he's been a longstanding advocate for that, has he not?
But he's not leading by example. This year, he's gotten contributions from over 40 corporations. Why couldn't he say?
Okay. And is there any evidence that Mr. Sarbanes' approach to policy is dictated by any of those corporations who are donating money to his campaign? Well, don't the corporations have a right to help elect the people that they think are best for the country?
Well, he's going to be more catering to their interests instead of the people he's supposed to represent, which is the citizens.
That's an assumption, though. But there are a lot of folks think that, and there's a lot of people who are very cynical about government in general because of that. But is there any evidence that that's the case?
So why couldn't he this year say, okay, I'm only taking contributions from citizen donors? That's leadership by example.
Dr. Flowers, what about you and the other big issues? We just have a minute or so left in terms of, in addition to healthcare, which is obviously something you're very well
versed in. So in terms of my opponent, Chris Van Hollen, I think that we're very different on foreign policy. You know, he supports aggression. I support downscaling the military and using a more cooperative and diplomatic approach, actually respecting national sovereignty and international law. When it comes to the international treaties like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and others that are coming down the pike, he has a history of voting for so-called free trade agreements. I've been fighting the Trans-Pacific Partnership for the last 5 years. We need a model of trade that actually lifts up standards for workers and protecting the environment around the world, not the current agreements that are driving it to the bottom.
We're going to have to call it there.
Okay, there's more. Go to my website, flowersforsenate.org.
We'll have a link to that website. Thanks to you both. We've been talking with two candidates running under the banner of the Progressive Maryland Green Party to represent Marylanders in the U.S. Congress. Dr. Margaret Flowers is running for the Maryland Senate seat, being vacated by Barbara Mikulski. And Abu Eze is the Green Party candidate for Maryland. Third congressional district. The Republican candidate for that seat, Dr. Mark Plaster, will join us here on Midday on October 26th. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for your calls and emails and tweets. And thanks also to the Baltimore Chef Shop for providing lunch for our guests today. They're on the Avenue in Hamden, offering a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, they're offering a class on Moroccan cuisine. Sounds good. You can check out the details about that event at baltimorechefshop.com. That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, our monthly edition of Health Watch, conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. We'll talk about the city's continuing efforts to keep the Zika virus at bay, and we'll take your calls. Plus, our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will stop by. She'll have a review of Wait Until Dark, the new production at the Everyman Theater. That's tomorrow on Midday, noon to 1, right here on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much to everybody who's chosen to be part of our fall membership campaign. We want to remind you about the importance of your support for your public radio. Andy Bienstock and Sheila Cast are standing by to tell you just how easy it is to become a member of WIPR.